lawyers aren't supposed to lie. You're not supposed to lie to opposing counsel. You're not supposed to lie to the court. You're not supposed to lie to the jury. You're not supposed to put on witnesses knowing that they're going to lie, and you're supposed to correct witnesses when they know a lie.
So if we agree with you and think, even if we think this is a very egregious violation, we still have to review this under Harrington v. Richter and think what the state court might have thought in denying this claim, and why is it unreasonable for the state court to have thought that even if this was a violation, it was harmless because there was so much evidence against your client?
Well, first of all, in a situation where you have no error, it's not a question of sufficiency of evidence. The reason I started off with this is the Brady area, you have every kind of area here.
So we agree with you that the state, we have to imagine the most reasonable thing the state court might have thought when it denied that explanation.
Well, you know, I'm at a loss to explain how any state court could accept this and find that there was no reversible error.
The problem I have is even if the jury totally didn't believe Johns, said we don't believe him at all because now we know that he had a deal, they don't believe him at all. Could the state court still have thought that the record of the verdict would have been the same because there was so much other evidence?
If that's the way the state court ruled, the state court would have been in error.
Why? Tell us why.
Well, that's what I'm trying to get to. Because the standard for this kind of error is not whether or not it would have changed the verdict. It's not whether or not the jury would have made a different decision, but could it affect the decision of the jury? Because it goes to the very heart of the truth function, finding function of a jury. If false evidence is presented, if the prosecutor lies, there's no excuse in that. Now, it isn't a per se error, although this court has said it's pretty close to a per se reversible error. But what it does is it asks whether or not the jury judgment could have been affected, not whether it was, whether it could have. That doesn't have to do with how much other evidence there is. And in this case, it would have been totally unreasonable for the court to find.
Wait, why doesn't it have to do with how much other evidence there was? I mean, if there's overwhelming evidence, say there are 100 witnesses that see the shooting, and then one of those witnesses had a deal and it's incredible, I mean, wouldn't it be reasonable for the state court to say at that point, yeah, there was an egregious thing that the prosecutor did here, but it doesn't make a difference?
Well, then, yes, it would have been error, because the difference is it has to talk about whether or not it's the type of error that could have affected jury's judgment.
And how could it if there are 99 other eyewitnesses in that hypothetical?
Well, but there weren't.
Well, okay, so that's different, but in the hypothetical,
we can obviously construct a hypothetical where the lie was an insubstantial matter in terms of the overall result of the case, for lack of a better word. But that's not this case.
Why not? Tell us why that.
Because the only eyewitness, the only person who said that my client shot the victim was Mr. Johns. Nobody else said that.
The son saw the shooting and saw the tattoos, and the girlfriend saw and there were a lot of other witnesses.
True, there were a lot of other witnesses, but the son said he didn't see much. I mean, his testimony, what's interesting about his testimony is that according to the general schema of the prosecution case, my client came into this apartment. The son is sitting there, sees my client come in, sees him talk briefly with the other lady who is there, and they go off to the room where the father is. So the room is well lit. He had an ample opportunity to observe him. He never made an identification. More importantly, he never was asked to make an identification. Not a single one of those people, except for Krista Scarborough, who is the girlfriend of Mr. Johns, and has to be viewed in interrogatory as it were with Mr. Johns. None of the other people identified the defendant there. None of them identified. Nobody else saw the shooting except Mr. Johns. And Miss Donnie the third, says he saw the skinny guy pull the gun out of his waist. But he didn't say that was my client.
Okay, could you help me? You've been discussing what happened in the trial.
Right.
Could you tell me what happened in the district court?
Well, I filed a petition. We had a hearing that was ostensibly about my request. request for the issuance of a 17C subpoena so that I can get a copy of the CD of the meeting. That sort of morphed into a general discussion of the case. The district court basically said that it didn't believe that anything that I raised had anything to do with anything because there was overwhelming evidence. But that's not the test. The district court never examined the question of whether or not it was the kind of evidence that could have affected the jury's decision.
But the district court did not issue a 16 subpoena.
No, it did not. There's a critical
point. It's a fact finding that there was no immunity deal.
I'm sorry?
Did the district court, the federal district court, make any fact findings in that hearing?
Well, not really. What the district court said is that there's some evidence that suggests that there might have been a cooperation agreement, but its boundaries were
I'm sorry, I said immunity deal, but I meant a cooperation
agreement. But whatever happens, the judge said, well, I didn't think there was enough there to make it clear that there was an agreement.
So is that a fact finding that we need to defer to under in a clear error standard?
The federal court just
yes. We're trying to figure out how to review what has already happened now in this federal court. It's kind of an odd procedural posture.
No, I understand that. He never made that finding. What he said is that there was the appearance of some kind of agreement, but it didn't rise to the level of something that he thought was a cooperation agreement. Which I gotta understand, and I'm sure the district judge would understand, because most of the time in federal court.
I mean, that sounds like you're saying there was no cooperation agreement. Is that a fact finding that we now need to defer to? We review the habeas case de novo.
Well, it's a conclusion of law, because he's saying, based upon the way he didn't disagree with any of the facts that I laid out in the writ, but he said, based on this, it's not enough to say that it's a cooperation agreement. That's not a fact finding. That's saying, all right, these are the facts. Under the law, that's not sufficient to constitute a cooperation agreement. So there's no deference required.
The record that the district judge was looking at was what you filed.
Correct.
And the district judge, I mean, I read it at least, concluded that the evidence you filed said there wasn't a cooperation agreement. Because it seems to be the basis of the rest of the findings. You're saying that that factual finding, because there was no other hearing, is not entirely different.
No, I'm not saying it's not a factual finding. In other words, he didn't find that, no, there was no discussion between the district attorney and the defendant. No, there was no discussion between the investigating officer and the defendant. No, there was no agreement between them. What he said was there's evidence that suggests that there might have been some kind of agreement, but that it wasn't in rise to the level of anything that I have to consider a cooperation agreement.
Isn't that a factual finding?
No, because it's saying under the law, the facts that you presented to me are insufficient. That's not a factual finding. He's not finding that this didn't happen, this did happen. He's saying, assuming all those facts that you laid out here happened, it's not enough. And that's a conclusive law.
And what was it that he did wrong there?
What he did wrong there was to ignore all the evidence to establish that he even categorized these guys two strikes. Somehow, he talks to the investigating cop. The investigating cop says, I'm a guy who makes you control whatever happens in your case. Cooperate with me, and I'll make sure you get the best possible sentence. So then he doesn't get charged with the initial crime. He gets released. 18 months later, he's back in custody. He allegedly wants him to talk to him again about some kind of improper influence with the trial attorney. It immediately segues into the fact that he's a parole hold and he wants to get out of custody. The investigating officer says, well, I'll see what I can do about that. Amazingly enough, the parole hold is released, and then the prosecution goes in and agrees to no bail. That's a first strike case. It involves it disregarded all over the place in this to get to this. And then, after the trial, the sentencing by the judge in Mr. John's case is absurd. The judge says, no, it's not an unusual case. No, he's been a bad boy in the situation. The conduct is increasing seriousness. The factors in mitigation are outweighed by those in aggravation. I can't impose probation because it would be illegal. And then he goes ahead and imposes probation. So, you know, I mean, if it walks like a duck and it talks like a duck, it's a duck. I mean, you have a three-strike guy who commits two crimes and ends up with straight probation. And the DA, I mean, better way to explain the fact that DA doesn't sit in no family members. They practice a lot of trial law. I'm trying to imagine a situation, Judge, my client has three strikes. He's here on a new case. I want him OR. I'm going to go, you know, I'm saying, not a chance. Here the DA says, let's go with us. And the judge just says, okay, you're OR. Now, that doesn't happen out of thin air. That happens because somebody's arranged that. There's no question that there was a cooperation deal. That's what Mr. Johns was hanging on for, and that's what he got. I have 4 minutes left. I'd like to reserve.
Thank you.
Good
morning, Your Honor. David Andrew Aldrich, Deputy Attorney General for Respondent. I can tell you exactly why in 2007 Mr. Johns did not end up with a case for sentence. It was before the jury. He spoke up at a time right after the shooting when he could have remained silent. So even though he theoretically could have gotten a two-strike sentence, the detective made clear that he was going to go to bat for him in 2007 regarding the shooting event.
I'm concerned about the standard of review. I'm not an appellate judge, so I get confused about it. They know it better than I do. But it seems like finding a fact of review, clear error. The decision to grant or deny on the habeas petition is reviewed de novo. I read the record, but I got to go back and look at it. The judge made factual findings, which he cited. If he does, we have to accept those. But there wasn't any further testimony, as I understand it. You looked at the same record you were looking at. What is our job, and what is the standard of review for the decision made by the district judge? He's suggesting that all those were conclusions of law and sufficiency of the proof. Your brief suggests no, we are bound by those findings. And I don't know the answer to that.
Whether a particular set of evidence establishes a given fact is necessarily a factual finding. Witnesses can testify. I testify to A, I testify to B.
Where is this evidence? The evidence is all in the state court record.
Oh.
Is this all the district court judge?
The district court did not consider live testimony, but it, of course, considered evidence.
So the district court judges always look at state court records in habeas, and we always review what they say de novo. Why is this different?
You don't review the factual things, no.
Well, we do. We do. I mean, no, in habeas, unless there's testimony, I don't think. Can you point to any case where we?
Yes,
we can. Okay, do that.
Anderson, it's right in the brief. This court, no matter what the factual basis in this district court is, this court considers for clear error. That is, it's on page 8 of my brief, Federal Civil Procedure 52.
You're saying, Anderson, that's not a habeas case. I'm asking you for a habeas case in which we don't review the merits of the habeas claim de novo, which is, Anderson, the city of Bessemer is not a habeas case.
It's a case of general application. Habeas doesn't have any different principles, Your Honor.
Well, it does because it limits when you can have a hearing and when you can have further factual development. We have to take the state court records. I mean, all of the things that help the state are about how there can't be further development in federal court, and you're trying to say there was further development in federal court here.
I'm not saying there was further development in federal court, other than the fact that the court agreed to consider arguendo a declaration that was not made in the state court. But whether or not new evidence is admissible in federal court is only a question of law, not a fact. So if you sit.
It would be helpful if you could point us to a habeas case in which our court reviewed something that the district court said in evaluating the habeas petition for clear error instead of de novo. Or you should just say it could be de novo and move on.
It's not de novo. I can give you a case. I imagine clear habeas cases that came down. If you look at it today, we'll clear it up. You decide you vote to now go on the petition, but that includes factual findings for clear error. I would imagine the latest 10 cases from this court would say precisely that.
I must confess that I am confused by this case.
rest. And nobody is arguing. And I could you explain to me what is the nature of the state court ruling that we think we have?
The state court did not articulate its actual findings. No, that doesn't mean that there weren't any. It's simply that we don't want to report.
There was no reason.
Well, not articulate. I it's hard to
think. We're preparing to be reviewing the state court.
Yes.
And so it seems like what we should do is use Harrington and review the state court, but you're trying to add something we're supposed to do given what happened in the district court, and that is not what we usually do, so you have to explain why it's different here.
There are at least two ways to tie a decision on. You can look at what the state court recently could have found and affirm on that ground, or if the district court, for example, can make de novo findings to which you defer to.
Under what rule could the district court make de novo factual findings in this case? What rule allowed them to have an evidentiary hearing on the habeas claim here?
Well, when you say evidentiary hearing, the court can make factual findings without an evidentiary hearing. Because the evidence
is this whole state court record, is it?
The evidence, most of the evidence is the state court record. That's correct. However, a district court can make factual findings, just like appellate courts do at times, on something other than one testimony.
You said most of the record is a state record. What is it?
The declaration, there were two declarations filed in district court for the first time, and he says to one of them, the court said, he's considering it for you and me. So, because it's not.
And what about the other one?
I don't know the answer to it.
So it seems like the extra evidence didn't matter, so the district court was reviewing the state court record just like we're supposed to review the state court record, and usually we do that de novo.
You certainly sit in the same position as the district court does in looking at what the state court could have found. But in that case, you're not looking at district court factual findings at all, because the determination of what a prior court could have found is not itself a question of fact.
Why is the district court in any better position to make findings on that record and review that record than we are?
I don't know for sure whether it is, but the rule of the appellate rule still applies that factual findings are confirmed to you for clear error.
There are about a million cases from our court that say that we review habeas cases de novo.
Yes.
And district courts always talk about what happened in the state court, and then we review it de novo. And I'm not sure what's different about this idea that there wasn't an agreement than any other thing district courts say about a state court record in all the habeas cases that we review de novo.
I would happily supply you with a case where the statement that we review de novo is rapidly followed with review factual findings by
the state court.
The district court.
Okay, well, it would be helpful if you could show us that.
I will have one for you. And I will get it right
out. In each case where there wasn't testimony in the district court, like a new hearing.
I understand. There's reason why citation in this brief points out it doesn't matter what the evidence source is, including each of these entry lines.
Well, why don't you explain to us why your adversary is wrong in saying that if you look at the state court record, it's apparent that there must have been some kind of an agreement?
Because the mere fact that someone does something on day 10 doesn't mean that there was an agreement to do it prior to day 10. All he has is that eventually someone did their job by testifying in his trial, and the prosecution took it into account later when he had some case to do. That's really all there is.
In 2009, there was a discussion where they're talking about, can you ask for parole, and what am I going to testify? And then Johns gets into court and says, we never talked about both things in the same conversation. That was blatantly false. How is it not an APOA error to not correct that testimony?
I can tell you that I can see state court reaching a contrary conclusion because there are things that happened before that particular passage. His counsel at trial was asking.
Says we never talked about
it. The question is what it is.
And also, what was the question in which he was responding before he said it?
Again, that's precisely what I discussed in the brief. But, give me a second, I will locate it. He had been announced that this was an evidentiary hearing and that the excerpt record 700.
challenge is starts, and let me try another way. The question is what? The question the court clarifies. The question is, was offered any inducement to testify? So everything falls from that. Well, do you understand what it is, please? Yes. He's not, thank you. And if being offered a reward or something for your testimony, he knows.
You read it so fast, I didn't hear a word you said.
I'm sorry, I will. Thank you, Your Honor. The court clarifies that what we're talking about here is whether he was offered any inducement to testify. So that sets the tone for how the jury's going to understand the passage that follows. Counsel, were you either offered, well, do you understand what an inducement means? Yeah. You do not? Yes, I do. And that's being offered a reward of some sort, something for your testimony. It was not. Right. Yeah. In this year testimony, you were never offered anything. By who? By law enforcement, the district attorney's office, or anybody. Offered nothing from none of those. Did you on your own offer your testimony in return for hoping to get some sort of relief later on? No. Me and the DNA have never spoke about this case in that case together. No law enforcement, no nobody. It's never been brought up in the same conversation. It is the idea of an agreement. It is the idea of something. It is exactly what the court explained. To follow me, whether he was offered an inducement, not simply whether or not.
So, when did you offer your return for hoping to get some sort of relief later on? And I don't see how the answer to that question is anything else. Reading
what he offered. If he offered to testify in order to get rid of an inducement, the report doesn't show that. The report shows he asked about parole. He got shut down and then he explained he was still testifying.
Can you address if we think this was a violation, why it doesn't make a difference to the outcome?
Well, the evidence is overwhelming. For one thing, he identified him in 2007 at the time he was being a fool to identify someone other than the actual person with him. Again, there was more than one witness.
Sorry, say that again. There was what?
There was more than one witness to the shooting. The victim's girlfriend is here. 2 hours later, he finds him in
the
prison.
Is it John's girlfriend? I don't think it's the
both girlfriends.
Oh.
Father Paul's girlfriend is there. And there's no way you would expect, you're talking to this, no way you'd expect that they identify some person who wasn't there and she's going to go along with it. The son was there. Again, this is his love, this is his father. If I identify some person who wasn't there, there's no way he's going to agree with that. If I, who have felony and two prior strikes, and then in a 25 life, all I have to do instead is identify the correct person. That can be seen as an overwhelming case by the state court. The fact that this was the location where people at the party bought drugs, they had someone who wanted to buy drugs, at this exact place earlier, they came back with more drugs. They start running out of drugs, I guess, that's what normally happens. And they say, go get some more drugs from that same place, and the defendant walks out with someone's keys, with Christy Scarborough and Christopher Johns. Defendant with his neck tattoo. Shortly thereafter, at that same place, Christy John show up with a third person who has a neck tattoo. That person's going to start shooting, and then they show up back at the party, and defendant still has the keys. That's an overwhelming case. That's the person who's there who did the shooting. Thank you.
But we have to say that the state court, in this hypothetical Harrington world, that the state court violated clearly established law established by the Supreme Court. So we need a Supreme Court case that says there's no way you could find this type of thing to have not made a difference in this trial. And so this, I'm not sure we can use our own case. No, we have to say that the state court violated Supreme Court authority in rejecting this claim. And so you're citing something from our court, but we need to, in order to grant habeas, we need to find that the state court violated Supreme Court law.
I got one for you. Kyles versus Whitney. The court in Amato was quoting Kyles versus Whitney at 514 U.S. at 434. I mean, basically, falsely that the shoes were red and they were really blue. Okay, then the judgment is, no, this is not going to affect the judgment of the jury. But when you have the sole eyewitness who actually sees the shooting and identifies the defendant, and he's the person who tells the jury that he's coming in there at a good
time. But we take his testimony out of the trial. It never was in the trial at all. Is there any other outcome that the jury could have thought in terms of who was the shooter here?
Yeah, but that's not the analysis that you do here. That's what you do with Brady. And it's a tough one. With Brady, that's what you do. Brady seems to have affected the judgment. Here is, could it have affected the judgment? It's very
important. So, same question. How could it? How could the jury
have? Well, you have no eyewitness to the shooting.
But we have somebody who says, I saw the neck tattoos of the shooter, and the neck tattoos match the neck tattoos. So, how do we get around
that? They didn't testify to that because he didn't get the stand, and they didn't point out his tattoos. And was there? Johns also had tattoos.
Neck tattoos?
Yes.
Is that in the record?
Somewhere. I mean, I don't have it, you know, at fingertips. But he said there were these tattoos all over his body. So, the point of it is that when a prosecutor deliberately tries to skew the jury by presenting false testimony, by lying, the standard is totally different from breaking.
Is lying the testimony about what was discussed at the same time?
That's one of them. The other one is if you elicited it from him that he never, from Mr. Johns, that he never asked for anything. And it's nonsense. It's all over the transcripts of his interviews with the detectives. That's exactly what he's doing. You know, this is one of these guys who's bearing the system.
All right. And, all right. You want to write a opinion, but have to have at least what you're saying was a lie.
Right. I understand
two things. One is the first thing we talked about what was talked about in
the second one was that he never asked for consideration. The third one, of course, is that my client is the bad guy. But that's not proof to lie at trial. But the point of it is that Johns took the position, he gave a totally misleading affect that he's here, and he agreed he's here at the bottom of the goodness of his heart. And in other words, they responded, referred to him doing his civic duty. And nothing could be further from the truth. This is a three-time convicted felon who was playing the system for his own benefit. It happened in sentencing. It even happened in a case that happened in the afterwards when he got arrested another time, and he tried to play the same card again by saying that he's entitled to consideration from the prosecutor. The prosecutor said it's not a good idea to sell the same card to the same person twice.
Thank you, counsel. I think we have your argument. It would help me if you are able to find something that shows in the state court record that Johns has neck tattoos, if you can file something that tells us where that is, that would be great. Thank you both sides for the argument. The case is submitted.